When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to the TWS Sports Podcast.
That were the words, we don't want to finish in the Champions League.
But every time it was going wrong, we just kept turning around and blaming the coaches.
So he literally gets what he wants and whatever he says goes.
And we ended up getting relegated that year, which I think was down to, you know, what was in that dressing room at the time.
Well, it was really Sky that put an end to that. They may not have handled it very well.
Hello and welcome to the TWS Sports Podcast, the only podcast in the UK which is hosted by autistic students who interview some of the biggest names in sport. This podcast has been set up by Technolwood School and our aim is to teach our students new skills through podcasting. Each week we chat to famous sportsmen and women from around the world. We delve deep into their sporting careers, their highs and lows, and what makes them one of the best athletes in their sport. All of our students' hard work and dedication has paid off as we have recently won a Global Sports Podcast Award for the Best Equality in Social Sports Podcast. That's enough from me. I'm going to hand you over to the stars of the show, which are our students who host the podcast, and I will let them introduce today's guest. Thank you.
Technolwood School is a school for autistic children and young adults, and we have set this podcast up to provide our pupils with a fantastic opportunity to develop a range of skills whilst interviewing top sportsmen men and women from a variety of different sports. Joining us today on the TWS Sports Podcast is a former England cricketer. He spent that majority of his career at Leicestershire and is now head coach at the club. Welcome to the podcast, Paul Nixon.
Hi, Tim. Good, you okay?
Yeah, we're all right.
We like to start our podcast with some quick fire questions before we start talk about your career. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
Who is the most famous person in your phone book?
Good question. I think Gerard Butler.
What is that?
He was with us in the Caribbean Premier League a few years ago. He was involved with our franchise, the Jamaican Talawars. So I've still got his number.
Oh, that's good. Okay. If you could trade lives with anyone for a day, who would it be and why?
Probably somebody like Lewis Hamilton. I love cars. I love fast cars and I love driving. And I love F1, and I think, to go on those tracks in those great cars would be incredible.
Nice choice. Last question. If you were the ruler of your own country, what would be the first law you'd put in place?
Wow, what a question these are. First law, zero tolerance on bullying at schools. Zero tolerance.
Okay. So that's definitely needed. Mm-hmm. I want to take you back to the start. What are your memories as a child, and did you always want to be a cricketer?
Well, I grew up in the northwest of England, in the Lake District. I was a farmer's son, so I was up early on the farm. I had a sports mad father who played football and cricket, and Carlisle United was my football team, and our football team still is in the second division there. And we were passionate supporters. I was lucky that I played. My dad pushed me to all sport: football, cricket, rugby, basketball, cross country, athletics. golf. So I did everything. And luckily for me, cricket was always more natural for me. And I didn't start wicketkeeping until I was about 10, 11 years old. And I loved being involved in every ball. And for me, yeah, I was wanting to play football. But it was harder work for me to keep getting up the levels. I played sort of county schoolboys, and then I was sort of training with Carl United second team and playing for Penrith first team. But actually, we were managed by Bob Stoker, who came and managed us for a few games, which was amazing. A legend football manager who took Sunderland to the FA Cup final a few years earlier than that. So cricket was always natural for me. I had a good progression in cricket. So, I loved Ian Botham and Viv Richards and David Gower, watching them as a kid on the sofa, watching the test matches and the one day games. And I visualized being there and wanted to be there. And I knew that it would take some hard work, but I was prepared to do that.
Okay. You join Leicestershire and made your debut in 1989. What were your memories of joining the club?
Well, I was from a minor county, which is Cumbria, as far as cricket is concerned. There was no Durham then in those days. I trialled a little bit for Lancashire, and they'd signed Warren Hegg, wicketkeeper, because with cricket, with at the time 17 counties, there's only really 17 jobs. So I was Warwickshire on trial. They just signed a guy called Keith Piper. And I was really fortunate that through playing England schools and North of England and England schools, and then the English Schools Festival was in Truro. It couldn't be any further away in Cornwall from Cumbria, the opposite end of the country. I went down there and did well. And a guy called Don Wilson was watching, who was sort of one of the top guys at MCC. I was lucky to go to Lords and be based at Lords and do cricket there, but also go on trial. So I went on trial to Leicestershire and I did well, and they signed me up. And luckily, one of the wicketkeepers got injured and it gave me an opportunity to play. So I made my debut.
They got injured?
Yeah, he got injured, and it was lucky for me that he got injured.
Not much for him.
And I came to the... Exactly. A guy called Philip Whittycase, he did a bit of coaching. He was Leicestershire head coach as well down the line just before me. And a really good guy, Phil, really good guy. We worked really well together. And, he had great values. He had a good work ethic as a cricketer. And, he was a really genuine guy, and we still got on really well now. So I remember 1989 being an exciting year. I actually signed in at 88 and I made my debut in 89. My debut was against Warwickshire, who were a brilliant team at that time. But we had a good team. We had a lot of international players. David Gower was England captain, I think, at the time. He was our leader. A guy called Peter Willey, Les Taylor, a guy called John Agnew, who's now on the radio, TMS. Aggers was a fantastic fast bowler. And I remember keeping wicket to him, standing so far back. It was crazy. It was like a whole cricket pitch and a bit more back. He was bowling that fast. And we had a couple of West Indian players as well. So it was an exciting time with some good players. And it just made me aware that, wow, I've got to improve to be at this standard every day. And I loved it because it was a nice, positive environment.
Okay. What was that dressing room like in the 90s? Who were your good friends and who were the practical jokers?
One of my good friends was Alan Mullally, who came over from Australia. We sadly had a fast bowler called Richard Edmonds, who was an England under-19 fast bowler, who was like 6'3", 6'4", wonderful prospect. But sadly, Richard died in a car crash, and we had no left armour for a little while. And then Alan Mullally came. We saw him bowling in Australia, realised he had an English passport, so he could be a home player, not an overseas player. And Alan and I got on like a house on fire. Since then, he's had a few troubles, he's had a tough time in life. But he's retired now from his cricket. But he was a real practical joke. He always super gluing your shoes to the floor, or putting crisp packets in your shoes, and in little daft things, shaving foam in your in your gloves or things like that. They were always happening all the time. People putting smelly bits of fish in your car bonnet and things like that. There was always some shenanigans going on. And, you know, the dressing room at that time was quite a selfish dressing room, being honest. A lot of people just looking after their own game and not giving to the team. It's a much more of a team positive attitude and mindset now than it was back then. Then it was a little bit more survival and make sure that you're all right when you're playing or if you're bowling. It was a little bit more selfish. But now we're much more together and we're much more about our team identity and our team culture and our values as a team, and making sure that, you know, we are, you know, we want to be the hardest working, most caring cricket team at Leicestershire. So, you know, we care for each other a lot more than we did years ago. And
the Super Glue incident reminds me of that time we interviewed this football player, and apparently one of his teammates used to cut triangles in the back.
I remember
of their
that, yeah.
Jerseys.
Yeah, well, we had guys that used to take your trousers up before a big dinner at the dry cleaners. They'd go and get the trousers and take the trousers up a few inches so they're in the middle of your shins rather than on your shoes. We used to have guys that used to cut holes in your shirt sleeves or your socks, the end of your sock. So you put your socks on and your foot just goes straight through the sock, or in your boxer shorts, in your undies. There's always practical jokers, but it was always good fun because we're like the big brother house. You live in the big brother house together every day for 6 months. At the moment, that's between April and September. At the moment, we are training hard in the gym and doing cricket in the indoor centre, so which we've got at Leicester.
Yeah, it's a bit too cold for outside.
Exactly. We'll do some field.
Who wants to risk letting your players catch a cold?
True.
They're cold to minor, but they're nasty.
They are. We don't want them. Because when one person gets it, everybody gets it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we generally have on Fridays, fun Fridays, which we go outside onto a, it's called Ellesmere College, which is a college for kids with special needs, which is wonderful. And they've got an amazing 4G football pitch. So we go on the football pitch and do some sprints, some running and some fielding. And then if the boys do a great job of that, then they're allowed to play football. So they love their football on a Friday, a fun Friday.
But they're cricketers.
Yeah, but we love all the guys who are cricketers and sportsmen, all of other sports. So, you know, we have a laugh and we have to do, you know, we have fun with it. And it's also a good conditioning session. So the lads do a lot of running.
At least no one's tried to hit a football with a cricket bat yet.
Yeah. You're right there.
I just hope no of your teammates are listening. Your team is listening to this. They might get ideas.
You could have brought me a new game into my mind now. I think I might try a new game.
Okay. You won two country championships in the late 90s. What are your memories of that?
Yeah, you know, winning the county championships is a really special achievement because it's like winning the Premier League. You know, it's such a long marathon of games that you play. So to be the best outright over every game in the longest format, which is four-day cricket. So every game's got two innings, first innings and a second innings. So it's each game's four games, 17 four-day games. It was a brilliant achievement. And you always have ups and downs, and there's, you know, some days, because in sport and certainly cricket, you have more down days than up days. You probably have 60, 70% bad days compared to good days. So if you take the very best batsman in the world, everybody wants to score 100 as a batsman. That's the benchmark, to try and score 100. Yet the very best average 50. So that means the very best fail 50% of the time. So, you know, mere mortals like us guys who, you know, the guys and the England girls now who are doing really well, you know, we're going to fail a bit more than that. So you have to be really strong mentally to keep going back at it and keep working hard and actually keep your own game in a good place, but also your teammates in a good place. So we help each other a lot. And that takes a lot of pressure off coaches as well. So it's important that, you know, the team works hard together. And in 1996 and 1998, when we won the county championship, we were terrific together. Yeah, we were. And actually, I don't know if you know, but when you win the county championship, you go to Buckingham Palace to collect your trophy and your medals. And we went to Buckingham Palace a couple of times and met the Duke of Edinburgh. I actually got the picture near me here in the living room. So, yeah, we had a great day at the palace where you meet members of the royal family and you get your trophy and your medals there, which is great, a great day and a great experience for the club and your families as well. Your families come as well.
You have the nickname Badger. Why is that your nickname? Badger? Come again? Badger.
The Badger, yeah. Well, a couple of reasons, really. One, badgers are nocturnal creatures. They come out at night. I used to enjoy a night out when I was a youngster. I used to enjoy a party and go to a nightclub in and have a bit of a boogie. So my nickname was Badger because I was always nocturnal. But people sometimes say that if you're a badger of your sport, that means that you love your sport and you like to immerse yourself in it. And actually, I was a bit like that as well. So I was a badger with the cricket and I was a badger in the evenings as well. I used to like going out at night.
Each week on the podcast, we like to play a game with our guest. We will say a name of a former teammate of yours and we want you to tell us a story or something about them.
Okay.
Jonathan Agnew.
Aggers. Aggers, a funny story, reminds me of Jonathan Agnew, he was once playing cricket for Leicestershire and the ball went down to him and he just bowled a long spell and he should have dived and stopped it and didn't dive and didn't stop it. He went for four. And the bowler at the other end was called Gordon Parsons. And his nickname was Bullhead because he used to have a head of Semtex. He was very explosive. His mindset was very angry when he wasn't happy. So Aggie let the ball go for four. So Aggie let the ball go for four. And Bullhead went, Aggie, you idiot. What are you doing? Why have you done that? You've cost me four runs. That is ridiculous. And Aggie's gone, Bullhead, you've played for 15 years. What's four more runs when you've gone for 30,000? And he goes, okay, yeah, fair enough, actually. Yeah, it doesn't make much difference, does it? So that was a little Aggie story.
Darren Maddy.
Darren Maddy. One of the first things that Darren, when we used to have pre-seasons, which is where we are now in our, you know, the season starts in April and in a couple of months, we used to have to run down to we didn't have a gym there in those days, and we used to have to run to the Leicester University Polytechnic gym down the road in Leicester. So we had to go out to the ground, run down the canal, go up some stairs, over a bridge, and then into the canal, which is about a mile and a half, 2 miles. We have a workout, and then we run back. And James Whittaker, our captain at the time, said to Darren Maddy, Darren, I'm 32 years old. If I ever beat you back to Leicester ever again after the gym workout and the run back, you won't play for Leicestershire. And Darren Maddy never, ever, ever let James Whittaker beat him back after that. He was always second. He was always second behind me on the way back. Made sure he's never going to be the last. And actually,
blow up.
He now's got two sons, Darren. He's got George and Isaac, who are, I think George is 17, just started driving. He's on the Warwickshire Academy. He's already made his first class debut. And the youngster, Isaac, who plays, I think, under 15, under 16, so he's going to be a little star as well. So he's got two boys who are both passionate for cricket and going to do well.
I'm starting to think it's genetic.
Yeah, it must be.
Yeah, Rob Key.
Rob Key.
His name sounds strange. Don't tell him I said that. Oh my God, yeah, I'm so sorry.
He's the sort of new boss of English cricket, the new supremo. Keezy used to love playing touch rugby in the morning. He used to love playing touch rugby as a warm-up. So most cricket teams, the lads like to have a game of football as a bit of a warm-up. So three touches, no contact. So don't get tackled each other. You have to stay on your feet, no sliding tackles. Because a lot of guys have got injured and broken legs playing football, which is crazy.
Yeah, professional and unprofessional alike. Yeah. I'm starting to think these sports are more dangerous than they are fun.
It's a bit like that. Rob Key used to always sulk. Whenever his team lost, he was a bad loser. He hates losing. So Keezy used to go and sulk all the time. He used to always throw his toys out of his car. Every time we had something that was a competition, whether it was touch rugby or football or a game in the net, he'd always march off with a big losing sulk on board. Yeah.
Lisa didn't go into the corner and let mushrooms grow around him going,
We chatted to...
Couldn't leave mushrooms because his kit was everywhere in the dressing room.
Stuart Broad.
Crikey. Well, Broadie had such an amazing meteoric rise, such a fast rise to playing cricket. He was really mature ahead of his years. He went to a fantastic school at Oakham. He had some good cricket coaches. And he played a game, literally, I think his debut at Oakham School. So he played a few second team games. He was on the academy. He played a few second team games, straight into the first team. Did so well in the first team. He got 5 wickets on his debut. He then went straight into England team and was on fire all the time in England, as you see now. But I was so pleased to play cricket for England with him in Barbados, one of my last games for England, which would beat the West Indies in a brilliant run chase that Kevin Peterson got 100 in. And I got out needing one or two to win. And Stuart Broad came in and hit the winning run. So we had a great celebration in the dressing room afterwards. So Broad is a great man and a good friend.
Thank you for answering those questions. You were involved in the start of the 2020 competition in 2003. In 2003, did you think the competition would turn into the worldwide competition it has become?
Well, you know, it has been an incredible journey, hasn't it? All of us actually who played, like probably your dad's age, we all played cricket in the evenings. I certainly played in Cumbria. We used to play 17 8-ball overs back in those days. And we used to play in the evenings when the sun, you know, it was bright sunshine till late and, you know, it went dark at 10, 10:30. So we played a lot of small games and everybody loved it and it was accessible to everybody in league cricket. And then the professionals decided to do this. And we loved it. Straight away, we loved it. Because Leicestershire at that time, we had a lot of players that were really good at batting and bowling and maybe not international standard at either. But we had a really good team of thinkers, a good fielding team, guys that could hit it hard and powerful and fighting boundaries. And actually, the 2020 just it fit with our team really well. And the guys, we had a week off before the T20 started. And we just tried loads of centre wicket scenario practice sessions. And we tried loads of things, different people at different places. So by the time the games came around, we knew what roles everybody had. And everybody had real good role clarity. Who was going to open the batting? Who was going to go two down? Who was going to bat after the 6-over power play? What spinners were going to bowl in the power play? Who was going to bowl at the death of the innings right the last few overs? So we had a good practice time to be able to plan and prepare for it. And then we did well because we were in 5 finals and we won 3 of those 5 finals, which is, Leicestershire is still the leading trophy holders. We still got the best record in T20 cricket in England. Mm.
Is it true that you trained with the Leicestershire Tiger rugby team? Why did you do that?
Yeah, I did. You've done your homework. I'm very impressed with your homework. I knew those guys because Leicester Tigers, Leicester Football, Leicester Cricket are all within literally a mile of each other. So 1 kilometre of each other. So, and actually, I live not a million miles away from the training ground. So the guy who was one of the trainers at the time, a guy called Chris Toombs, he loved playing cricket. He loved his cricket as well. So he played at, I think it was Surrey under 16s. So he messaged me and said, Nico, anytime you ever want to come down and train, please do. Because I used to love training. I always enjoyed training hard from my football days and playing rugby as a youngster. I captained Cumbria football, rugby and cricket. So I loved all my sport. And I enjoyed the rugby guys, you know, anything that would make me better. And they have different training methods. They're much stronger than footballers and cricketers. So I took a lot of their training methods into my cricket, and that helped me have longevity in my cricket because I played for 23 years. So I played in the 80s, in the 90s, the 2000s, and right over till 2011. So I played for 4 decades. So it was that that training mindset and that training knowledge that helped me keep fit and strong and fast all those years.
You made your England debut at the age of 36. Do you think you should have made your debut sooner? And what are your memories of your first match against Australia?
Yeah, it took me a long time to get there. I thought I was going to get there in 1995. I'd scored 1,000 runs in 1994. I had a good year, and England were looking at me because Alan Knott, who was the England ex-England wicketkeeper, was the England wicketkeeping coach, and he came to the games and he was hitting balls at me before matches with his cricket bat. He was smacking balls and getting me to dive around and looking at my technique and how good I was. And what sort of type of person I was, and if I was hungry and passionate, and you know, and I was there for England. So I'd done well, and then literally the very first game I got picked on the England A team, the second team at the time. It's called the Lions now, and the A team. I had a good tour to India and to Sri Lanka, which we did well in, and then they came back, and I thought, this is my year. 1995, this is my year to make it for England. And the very first game we played against Warwickshire, who were the champions of the previous summer, which they were amazing. They won three trophies and they were runners-up in the fourth trophy in all four formats that we played. So they were amazing. And they had a fast bowler called Alan Donald, whose nickname was White Lightning. He used to bowl at 92, 93 miles an hour.
Boy!
Whoa.
Yeah. That name reminds me of something from an anime I watch.
You're right there. And he was scary. He was seriously scary as a bowler. And he bowled the ball to me and it bounced and it hit my thumb. And I was on 51 not out. And I thought, I'll come back tomorrow. We were batting tomorrow at the end of play. I thought, I'd get a nice 100 tomorrow and England will pick me to play in the test matches. And the ball bounced and I hit my thumb. And I don't know if you can see it, but I've got, where's my camera? Is that my camera that side? I've got like a scar down here.
On my thumb. That means you broke your thumb.
And I snapped my thumb. So I had a 4-hour operation and I was out for about 10, 11 weeks. And that meant that Alex Stewart and Jack Russell got a gig for England and they stayed there for many years. They did so well, they stayed there. So it took me a long time to get there in the end. But I loved it. Going to Australia was amazing. Played a T20 game, first game in Sydney, 46,000 people watching. Dad was in the crowd and family were there and loving it. And I got beat, but I got a few runs. I got 30 off about 20 balls, 21 balls. Mm. I got really good, hit a big six. And I thought, wow, this is international cricket. I love it and I couldn't wait to play more.
Did you see any koalas?
I did see some koalas, actually. Yeah,
they're cute little things, aren't they?
They're gorgeous. Do you like koalas?
Yeah, they're adorable. Yeah, I would recommend ticking one off, though. They are wild animals.
Yeah, no, they can stay on the trees and they can stay chilled there. I'm happy with that. Mm-hmm.
You were selected for the 2007 World Cup.
Yeah.
What are your memories of getting the call up, and what did you think of heading to the World Cup?
Yeah, well, the World Cup was just after the one-day series that we'd had, the Tri-Nation series against Australia and New Zealand in Australia. So thankfully, the boys did really well in that. We did well and we won that series and we then went to the World Cup. And I got the call just afterwards from David Graveney, who was the chairman of selectors. And he said, Nico, I'm pleased to say you've done so well. We want to reward you with going to the West Indies and being the main wicketkeeper there. So we know you'll do well. Good luck. And for me, it was a nice way of going to do my best, because I felt that in Australia, I tried to get too many runs too soon in matches, because there's quite a few games that we were just behind. We needed more runs quickly. And I tried to do that at times and I got myself out. So it was really important for me that when I batted in the World Cup, I made sure I got myself in. I made sure I gave myself a bit more time to score runs. Because when you first go out to bat, the ball's like a little marble, it's tiny. Then as you spend time in the middle, in the crease, and you watch the ball and you play the shots, the ball just gets bigger and bigger. And eventually when you're in, it's like a beach ball coming towards you. It's like this big balloon coming towards you and you can smack it anywhere. So I made sure that I gave myself time to do well. And I had a really good World Cup. I played nice and positively, got us in some good scores, and you know, and I did well. I was pleased with my performance, so I can look back and say that I did myself proud in those World Cup, which is.
And speaking of West Indies,
yeah, you were at the World Cup in West Indies and the famous night out. Is it right you got fined and you can talk to us about it? And what did Duncan Fletcher say the following morning?
Yeah, it was a...
You got fined? Very excited. What did you do?
We were all very excited about going to the World Cup, as you could imagine. And we went for a couple of quiet drinks. And the couple of... We had... I think we had something like... We were playing something like Canada in a few days' time. So they had a slightly less powerful team. And... we had a few too many drinks. I had drinks, but not too many. I was okay because we were training hard and we were swimming in the sea the next day.
You were teammates.
And the teammates and some of my teammates had too many drinks. One of them was, which was Andrew Flintoff. He had far too many drinks. And he wasn't in a brilliant place mentally at that time, which is written about. And he ended up going on a pedal and falling off it, having too many drinks. And the manager, the next morning, the coach, Duncan Fletcher, made everybody stand up and say how much they had to drink, what time of night they got in that night. And he'd actually asked the security guys to find out as well the night before. So he knew who was telling the truth and who wasn't telling the truth. So he was very strong with the boys who weren't telling the truth. And Freddie Flintoff was still very, very drunk the next morning. He was snoring his head off. On the physio bench, not in a very good place. So anybody that came in after midnight got fined. And I was in like just after midnight. And then a few boys were a bit later. And the funny thing was, there was one of the guys called Kevin Shine, who was a fast bowling coach. He'd never seen his brother for many years. And I think his brother came over to see him and they were out with his brother and he didn't get back in till late and he got fined because he was after midnight. And he used to, Kevin didn't like spending money. He was quite stringent and tight with his money, and it made us laugh because he got fined and he wasn't really partying. He was only having a drink with his brother, but because he came in so late, he got told off. So yeah, so there you go. That was the infamous pedalo night.
If you haven't already, then be sure to download our new app, Gold, the home of challenges. Post and take on challenges, call out your friends, and top leaderboards. Challenges can be about absolutely anything, so be as creative as you like. Be sure to follow our social media too for awesome giveaways. That's gold.
We also read that you once did a seance with some teammates. Are you into the supernatural and did you experience anything?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. It was unbelievable because we were at a hotel in Durham and what happened was we were bored. The next day was talking about being rained off. It was going to be rained all day. We're in this big old hotel, an old hotel. And one of the guys said, I wonder if this hotel's haunted. And one of the guys...
So you decided to find out.
I think it was Darren Maddy, Darren Stevens, who went to Kent afterwards, John Sadler, myself and Brad Hodge, our overseas professional from Australia. And we decided to do a seance. And after about 20 minutes, we had this. We had things set up because Darren Stevens had done one before. I'd never done one, and the glass moved. We had our fingers on the glass, and the glass was going all around the table onto letters that we'd put around the table and spelling out words. And we had 4 hours speaking or being connected with the spirit, and they were telling us things about our life that only we knew. And we were speaking with and connecting with families, our families who were in the spirit world. It was the most incredible experience I've ever had. And it was all very new to me. And it really was quite a calming experience, believe it or not. And it was exciting, but calming at the same time. And they told us things that only we knew. Mm. I only knew my grandfather's name of his favorite dog and things like that that nobody else would know. And And my grandfather had passed away, and the dog had passed away many years ago, but I knew the names. And, you know, it spelt all the names out correctly, and it did that with everybody. So we were finding out things about ourselves and our families, which was amazing. And, yeah, but it's, you know, it's something that's got to be taken very seriously. And, you know,
because there are plenty,
people shouldn't do it.
Because there are plenty of TV shows where the moral of the story is, don't mess around with the Ouija boards.
Yeah.
Yes. And I would agree with that. I would agree with that. Yes. Yes. So it's important that, you know, people do it in a safe environment with adults around and make sure that, you know, just, you know, you don't have to do it. Just, you know, it's there, but, you know, treat it carefully.
You mentioned in your autobiography that you were offered millions of pounds to fix an England match. Can you tell us about that, please, and what happened?
No, England game. It was a county championship match. So it was a T20 match. You know, this guy and his brother spoke to me about fixing a game and some of our players to help fix the game. And something that I'm really anti, and it's not cool. And just don't do those things. So sport's about winning and losing, and the best team wins. And I wasn't about, you know, doing badly so people make money, because that's not sport. And yeah, this guy offered a lot of money to many of us, because one person can't make such a difference in a match. It has to be a few people. So it was quite a scary thing when I was sitting there talking to him in the end, because he'd been messaging me and built up a friendship through talking about properties and things like that, things I'm involved with. And eventually he then said, oh, I've got a business transaction for you if you're interested. And, you know, obviously I said no. So it was quite a scary thing, because it was a one-day game up in Durham, a T20 in Durham. And Durham had literally 8 or 9 international players playing. And we had myself and Matthew Hoggard, who were two old guys who were probably just on our way down as our professionals, really. We were just starting to get past our best. So, you know, Durham were massive favourites to win that game. And they knew that. And they wanted to make sure that there wasn't any upsets. But, you know, we weren't keen, we weren't involved, and we have to report it to the authorities, which we did. So, you know, and that's all we can do. So, yeah, we did the right thing. You know, we kept to our true beliefs and did the right thing.
As a wicketkeeper, you need to have a good relationship with the bowler. Did you ever have secret signals between each other so you could pick the bowler's deliveries?
Yeah, we did. I did that a lot with a guy called Ian Salisbury. Ian Salisbury, I was on the Lords ground staff, the MCC professionals at 16, 17. And he was a brilliant leg spinner, played for England and played for Sussex, played at Warwickshire, I think, as well. And Sol's, who's still a good friend of mine now, he is a very good googly, and I couldn't pick it very well because we never had a leg spinner at Leicester. So I wasn't used to keeping wicket to it. And I always knew that if a batsman went up the wicket and had a great big shot for 6 and missed it, and it went through the gap between bat and pad, I have a split second to see it. And I've got to make sure that, you know, if it's a googly, I'm going to my left. And if it's a leg spinner, I'm going to my right. And that can make a difference of a stumping or not a stumping of their best batsman. So I had to make sure that I could read him. So I asked him to give some little signals. So I used to walk down the line of the crease at the other end on his way back to bowl his ball if it was going to be a googly. So that was our little signal.
You got one wicket, and it was William
Porterfield. Porterfield.
Ouch.
Yeah. One wicket.
How did that happen?
Well, wicketkeepers all bowl. Everybody loves to bowl in the nets. But I just wasn't. I've got good skill. I know where to bounce it and how to swing it and all the rest of it. I'm just slow. It just comes out slow. So I've loved bowling. I'm a good net bowler off about 14 yards in the net. And I played a couple of games where the opposition only needed like 10 to win or 15 to win. So the opposite. So none of the bowlers want a ball. So it's a time to rest. So they say, come on, Nico, come and have a ball. And I was desperate to take a wicket. I was desperate. And Matthew Hoggard was captain. We played at Gloucestershire in Bristol. And they needed about 14 to win. Will Porterfield was batting as a left-hander. And I ran in and I swung it into him. And the ball before, I hit him, LBW, went forward. And the umpire, who was a friend of mine, called Rob Bailey, he used to play for England and played for Northamptonshire, gave it not out. And I was like, Rob, that is so out. How can you not give that out? That is so out. He goes, nah, I don't think it was fast enough to knock the bails off. So, but the next ball, he went back to the same ball and he went back and he went right in front of his stumps and he was hitting middle of middle stump. And I was like, Azat! And he gave him out and I was the happiest man in the world. We literally, there was a team pile on. I did my big celebration and the boys caught me up and I laid down and they just piled on top of me. I had like all 11 of them on top of me because it had taken me 23 years to get that wicket.
Being a wicketkeeper, you need to be a certain type of person and sledging is a part of the game. Didn't you sledge David Smith out once?
Yeah, there was not necessarily sledging. Good players find this mental space that they get in the zone. They talk about the zone where they're really focused and nothing gets in the way of that focus. And they're thinking about their processes. So they're thinking about watching the ball, playing straight and letting the ball come onto them. So they're talking, good self-talk in their own minds, positive affirmations. I tried to chip away at the batsman to make him feel uncomfortable and try and make him think he was going to get out and also remind him of how he got out in previous games. So I tried to play on his mind to make him be negative. So I gave David Smith a bit of stick one day and because he wasn't playing very well. And this guy was like 6'5", 6'6". Like literally his shoulders are like that wide. He's huge. He should play rugby. And he wasn't very happy. And then he got out. He was angry because he got out. And he walked past our dressing room door and he went, bang. And he put his fist through our dressing room door at Leicester. Wow. So imagine the guys who were in the dressing room, 12 men, 13 men.
Going, what?
God. Yeah.
So, and I was so worried. I thought he was going to punch me at the end of play. So I quickly got the 12th man to get my kit and my car keys. And as soon as we finished, I drove straight home because I was only young.
I'm out of here.
But he was
a classic, I'm out of here situation.
Yes, I was gone. I was gone. So he was funny. He was fine the next day when he calmed down.
You retired after the 2011-2020 final. You won the final against Somerset. What an amazing way to end your career. What are your memories of that?
Yeah, great day. Well, it was a real build-up to the final because we played against Kent at home in the quarterfinal and I'd played for Leicestershire and Kent. They were my two counties. So I was playing against guys I played with, like Rob Key at Kent. And we in the end of that game, I got a nice 30 off about 20-odd balls and we helped win the game and I got carried off with the crowd. And then went to the final. And we had a super over in the final as well, which was an amazing game against Lancashire. And it was an incredible game. And so we had the first ever super over in the finals. So we thought, you know, is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? Super over. We won that. Then it was the final. And it's quite a late game. And you go on until quite late. And we were batted first. Didn't get many runs. Had a good strike rate. Didn't get many runs. A smash one like a rocket, actually, right in the middle of the bat. And Kieran Pollard, the West Indian T20 specialist, who's got hands the size of buckets, and he catches everything. And he dropped it. And he dropped it again. Then he dropped it again. I think he caught it the fourth time or third time diving. And so I walked off the last time as a batsman. And then we came out to field. And, you know, I was determined that we won. And I was on fire at that time. I was like, chirping the batsman and giving them a bit of stick and giving Josh Butler a bit of stick and he wasn't very happy. And then Kieran Pollard came out, their key player, and the game was tight. They were looking like winning the game. But we knew the ball was getting older and softer. The wicket was getting more and more tired because they had a semi-final and a final on the wicket. And we knew that our spinners were going to win the game. And anybody that was big and strong that could hit fours and sixes with a soft ball on a turning pitch could win the game. So it was important that we got Kieran Pollard out. And he came in without a helmet on. And the guys in the game know that's silly because he should be A, safe, but also if you don't wear it, you're thinking about not wearing it. And he was just trying, he played on his ego a little bit. And we went at him as a team, saying, what are you doing? You're an idiot. Why are you doing that? We're going to bounce you. We're going to knock your head off. And he gave himself room. He didn't get in line. He gave himself room and edged one. And I took a flying one-handed catch straight in the middle of my hand, in the middle of my glove, went in perfect. And we got him out. And we knew that once we got him out, it was our game and we were going to win. So because the batsmen who were coming in after him weren't as good as him. And we had some good bowlers to come. So winning that game, we parted for a couple of days. I think I kept the medal on. We kept the medal on for about 3 days. And we celebrated with so many people in Leicester who were at that game. Every time I went out anywhere for dinner, people were saying, thanks for a great game. Let me buy you a drink. Yeah, you guys had a great competition. And well done to you guys. Well done to Leicestershire.
When you retired, you moved into coaching. You had spells in the Caribbean and you coached Chris Gayle and Mattia Marilifian. What are your memories of your time there?
Yeah, the Caribbean Premier League. It was a guy called Michael Holding, who was a very good fast bowler from the West Indies, called me and said, Nico, the West Indies, they need a coach in the West Indies for Jamaica. And would you be interested? And of course I would, to go to the West Indies. Beautiful temperature, amazing islands, passionate people. So I got the chance to go over there.
But you got fined.
Yeah, well, I got fined. Yes, I could go back to the bar that I got fined in as well, which we did.
Luckily, no one decided to have to give you a case of deja vu and fine you.
It was. So no peddlers, so that was cool. But yeah, went to coach there. We had a wonderful team. And we ended up winning it. We won it twice. Excuse me. So we won it twice in 3 years, which is brilliant. We had great fun. They call it the biggest party in sport, which it is. There's DJs playing music when the game's going on. There's bands in each part of the crowd in the different stands in the crowd. So wonderful achievement, great fun, carnival atmosphere, and I would love to do it again. The only problem is, it's actually on in August and September, which is when we're still playing county cricket now. So now I'm coaching Leicestershire. I can't do it. But maybe in the future, I would love to do it because it's great fun and they're amazing people.
You then became head coach at Leicestershire. How did that job come about and what was your biggest challenge when you first became their coach?
Yeah, well, I'd always loved coaching. I always loved trying to make people better, helping and supporting people, and also making myself a better coach and a better person. So I was approached by Wasim Khan, who was the then chief executive officer, CEO, and he said, Nico, would you be interested? The club, we need a strong character at the helm. We've got a lot of senior players who are just on their way out. We haven't won enough games over the last few years. We need to get the good times that Leicestershire had back again. So the biggest challenge I had at that particular time was releasing players who I didn't think were playing the game to try and play for England. They were just playing the game to pay their mortgage and to get paid and just have it as a day job and not try and get better every day and help each other around them every day. So the standards were low, the professional standards were low, the lifestyles that some of the guys were living were poor. There was too many people that were drinking too much, they were smoking, there was guys not taking their fitness seriously. And it was just an easy time. The culture was poor and the behaviours were poor. So I had to change that. So I had to make a lot of strong decisions. I had to build a management team around me of other coaches who had the same goals as me to win trophies and win championships and to try and create England players. And we have a saying at Leicestershire to have gold fox standards because the Leicestershire badge is a fox. And when you're a cap player, you get awarded your county cap. You get a gold fox, not a red fox, on your helmet and on your jumper. So I wanted to create gold fox standards, which is really important, which I think we're doing now. We're in a good place now, and I'm excited about this next summer.
In the four-day county championship, you have had a difficult time over the last few years. You have often finished bottom of Division 2. Why do you think this is, and what do you need to do to improve the situation?
Last year we didn't win a game, which was unfortunate. We got into a lot of positions to win games, and we had a bad session, one little bad session of the match. Each game has three sessions, a two-hour block, the morning session before lunch, then just after lunch to tea, then after tea till close of play. So there's 12 sessions in a game, and we would dominate a lot of sessions. Then we had one really bad session where we might lose five wickets or six wickets in a session, or our bowlers might bowl 15, 20 overs really badly and poorly and get hurt and go for six and over. And I think the reason for that was over the last couple of years. In fact, two or three in 2021, we had a reasonable year in four-day cricket. We struggled financially compared to a lot of the big clubs. A lot of the big clubs, they come and buy your best players. So we've lost a few players to big clubs. So just when you work with a youngster who's from an academy and he comes into the second team, then he comes into the first team, then all of a sudden he does well. The big clubs are like vultures. They come in for your best young players and they can offer them more money. So that's frustrating. But the remit was from me, you know, was to pick a younger team and to go on a journey with a younger team. So there's going to be a little bit of pain and there's going to be some games that we're going to lose. But actually, we're going to make this young team grow together and hopefully stick together and then start winning. And I think white ball cricket, we've been fantastic. We've been very close to winning in white ball cricket into quarterfinals and semifinals. We can do that. So I'm excited about this year. I think we've got, with the new signings we've got, Saul Budinger from Nottinghamshire, who's an amazing new young batsman that plays positive. We've got Matt Salisbury, a fast bowler from Durham, who's a high-class bowler. And overseas professionals, we've just added Rahane now from India, who's an amazing player, Indian test legend, who played a lot of white ball games as well, one-day games. So he's going to do well for us. So he's just been announced yesterday. So that's a great signing. He's going to go well. And we've got another one that I can't tell you about yet, another really exciting international player who's going to be announced in a few weeks.
That's exciting.
But, yeah, it is. Looking forward to it.
You have just signed a Ling. Why did you sign him, and what are you expecting from him?
Yeah, good question. We signed him because we've got a young group of players, an inexperienced group of players who haven't played a lot of cricket. And to be consistent, you know, young players can have talent, but they're not quite as consistent as senior players. So we want him to be consistent. But we've also heard, because he played at Hampshire, we also heard that he is a brilliant team player and he's really all about helping the youngsters grow and get better as well in their games and make them really good, have really good professionalism as well. So, yes, you can have the coaches, but actually when you're out in the middle, under pressure, to produce under pressure in matches, having a world-class senior player with you who's been there, seen it and done it and got the T-shirt, to have him with you in those key moments, having brilliant behaviours and having a great mindset, he'll help our guys develop out in the middle as well. And that's when teams win. So I think he's going to do really well. He's a brilliant guy and I think he's going to help all of our batsmen get better. That's why we signed him.
Do you think more needs to be done to improve the standard of county cricket in England?
I think it's a good standard, a really good standard. And I think the measure of the standard is how well England are doing. And I think England are playing such a great, exciting brand of cricket in Test matches. I know Sky's viewing figures were up 10% because of the way England were playing. They've picked a lot more white ball players, guys who played 50-over and T20 cricket, to play positively. So I think county cricket's in a really good place. They're looking at a few different things this year to try and help. There's a good chance we're going to be using a Kookaburra cricket ball, a different ball with a smaller seam.
It's a bird.
Great. Well, that's a very intelligent. I think that the Kookaburra is going to help batsmen score runs because it doesn't seem, the seam isn't as big as a Duke's cricket ball. The Duke's ball is quite a big seam on the ball and it nips around off the seam in England, where the Kookaburra swings a bit more rather than seams. It's not got as big a seam. We play white ball cricket with Kookaburras, and they play with Kookaburras in Australia and in Pakistan as well. So that's going to be something different.
As long as no one decides to set loose the actual living variant.
Kookaburra, yeah, we don't want that, because that will be that will go a long way, because it'll keep flying.
Can you tell us about the process of signing players in cricket? Is it similar to football, and how involved are you in buying and selling players?
Yeah, well, when we say buying and selling, we there's no transfer fees like football, which I think there needs to be, and that would really help teams to produce their own. And like us, we produce our own players. Guys come through the academy from 11 years old, 12, all the way up to like 17, 18, playing the second team, then playing the first team if they're good enough. And then it really harms us a lot when people like Stuart Broad do really well for us, and then all of a sudden Notts come in, and we offer them a new contract, but because they're a bigger club and a test match ground, their turnover of a business is way bigger than ours. So they can afford a lot more wages for some of those players. So that's frustrating. For me, I would like to see transfer fees. When they play for England and they've gone through your academy, you're getting money back from ECB. But I'd like to see transfer fees come in. I think it would really help small clubs get more money.
What are expectations for Leicestershire this season?
Yeah, well, you know, we want to win way more games in the county championship. I believe we've got the ability to be very close to promotion. I think we've got to be more consistent. We've got Rehan Ahmed now as well. He's playing for England, the leg spinner, the young leg spinner. He was the youngest player ever to play for England. And he's going to be with us as well, which is wonderful. There'll be different games he misses because he'll play for England again, I'm sure. My expectations are to, and I think the players will be the same, that we want to try and get into the knockout stages of white ball cricket, get into the quarterfinals, semi-finals, finals of a white ball format, and to really show a real good improvement in the county championship to finish, you know, mid-table and up and above. So we can do that. We all know that. It's just been a little bit more consistent for longer periods of time because we've got the ability, we've got the passion, we've got the fitness, we've got the standards. We've got to be consistent for longer periods of time. And that's our challenge, and that's where we are as a group. We're working hard now indoors to do that. So, bring it on. We can't wait for season 2023.
Before we finish, we would like to play a game with you that we play with all our guests. The game is called Wrong Answers Only. We will ask you a range of questions and you have to give us the wrong answer. Are you ready?
I'm not ready.
Favourite ground you have played at?
Selhurst Park.
Oh. Best player you ever played with?
Timmy Mallett.
Highlight of your career?
Swimming.
Favourite coach you played for?
Jose Mourinho.
Who's that?
The best thing about Paul Nixon is?
He's always sad.
Every week on the podcast, we like our guests to ask questions to each other. So we get a guest to ask a question, but they have no idea who the question is going to be for. This week's question comes from our previous guest, former Birmingham and Shrewsbury footballer Matt Sadler, yeah. What is your favourite Christmas film?
The Wizard of Oz. I watched it every year as a kid. The Wizard of Oz.
At Christmas?
Yeah, Wizard of Oz.
Nice.
All right. Each to his own, I guess.
Yeah.
Wizard of Oz, Dorothy in the red shoes. Wizard of Oz. Classic. Quite scary as well.
Could you do the same, please? Can you think of a question for our next guest, please? But we aren't going to tell you who the guest is. The question could be anything you want.
Anything.
Right. If the king comes for dinner, what are they going to cook the king? What's their best meal under pressure to produce?
That? Yeah.
Oh.
I would just like to say a big thank you again to everyone who listens to our podcast. We really appreciate it. Please continue to leave reviews and pass our podcast on to your friends and family. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today, Paul. We really enjoyed speaking with you, and it means so much to us as a school to be able to have the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. I loved it. Well done. If you ever want to come and watch us, or the school wants to come down and watch us, get in touch with me. I'd love to sort some tickets out for you all.
All right, then. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
So, Alyssa, how did you think about chatting to Paul?
It was great. He was a very funny guy.
Yeah, I'd say so.
I still can't believe people super glued their teammate's shoes to I have no idea what.
Yeah, not only that, but like the story was shocking about that guy who was like, wasn't it 5 foot? No, 6 foot five. And
the guy who punched a hole through the...
He was, like, huge, and he got, like, really annoyed over that, like, one time because of, like, what Paul did. So it's just, like, I can't believe that happened, but yeah.
I want to know, where the heck did they get superglue that strong?
Yeah. We hope our listeners enjoyed this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And, make sure to follow our social medias, which is Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And make sure, if you're not already, to subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is also DDOS Sports Podcast. And if you're not already, listen to us on either Spotify, Apple Music, or any other podcast services. Take care, everyone, and we'll see you all next time.
The TWS Sports Podcast combines autism and sport. This unique podcast is hosted by children with autism, and each week they interview famous sportsmen and women from around the world. The TWS Sports Podcast takes you deep into the sports star's career, their highs and lows, what happens away from the field of play, and so much more. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other podcast apps. The TWS Sports Podcast, where autism and sports combine.
Sports Social Podcast Network.